Day 2900 and 2901. We'll do a public hearing. We've got Representative Jeff Barker. You're here. You want to come up and give your testimony first? And Representative Donna Nelson is also signed up, or Matt Meter from her office. I'm not sure who. They're not here, so Representative, you have the courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm here on a couple of 2900 and 2901 House bills. And on the first one, on the message, for the record, I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative, District 28. I think the message of the potential impacts of the drunk driving cannot be said often enough. And by asking drivers to acknowledge before getting their license, that they understand that, I think will save lives. In conjunction with 2900, House Bill 2901 will strongly reinforce this vital message. Driving is a privilege and needs to be done responsibly. I hope you'll support this important bill. And we had testimony, a couple hours of testimony over in the House side, and DMV at that time, we was wanting them to put that information on the application. They said they'd be able to do that, and we actually had some forms here, and they showed how they could do that, where it could place at a very minimal additional expense, so that it wasn't going to be prohibitive. And I think that's really important too, that the DMV said they were going to cooperate with this and see to it that this went smoothly.
Okay, that's it. Any questions for Representative Barker? Anybody want to grill him?
You know, Mr. Chair, usually I'm up for the challenge. But.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your time. We'll then go to the top of the list here. Don Phillips, you've signed up. I think we'll do a public hearing on both of these together to kind of consolidate if I can.
And Mr. Chairman, you want me to...
Yeah, why don't you give us...
Real briefly, sir, if we're going to go both of them together just so no one gets confused. We're looking at the Angros version of House Bill 2900 and the Angros version of House Bill 2901. Briefly, House Bill 2900 makes a new traffic violation of refusing to take a breath test. It would be punishable by $500 to $1,000 fine. It would be handled like any traffic violation. You'd be cited into court, and it would have to be proved to a preponderance of the evidence to a judge, not a jury. Other part I will bring your attention to is in Section 5 of the bill, which is on the last page. And this states that the fines that are collected from citations issued on this by Oregon State Police troopers will be put in a special account, a state police account, which will be used to enforce DUI laws, and this will be applicable to persons arrested. This whole bill will be applicable to persons arrested on or after the effective date of this act. And I believe Representative Barker explained 2901. Basically, just as part of getting a driver's license or permit, a applicant would have to acknowledge that driving under the influence of intoxicants can result in serious injury or death and make an agreement not to do so.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Ringo.
A question for counsel. Currently, an officer can request that a breathalyzer test be taken only upon probable cause.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that's correct. I think the way it's stated is a reasonable suspicion, but you'd have to arrest. You have to have the probable cause to arrest to take them there. So it would be a probable cause standard, and currently refusing to blow, as you know, is grounds for suspension. And it's a longer suspension if you refuse than if you actually blew and failed, so that the prosecutor can then bring that evidence to the jury under our implied consent law and argue that you knew you were intoxicated and that's why you didn't blow.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Birdie.
I really like this idea of fining people for not taking the breathalyzer and diverting the money to drug driving enforcement. But I was just wondering if there had been any discussion about having a separate kind of arrangement for these fines, whether, you know, I think most of them go into the unitary fund, and whether there has been any discussion around that. Maybe other witnesses.
Yeah, I think we can talk about that a little bit later. I had a similar question with respect to where the other monies might go, so we'll just kind of leave that as an open question.
Good morning.
Ready?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I would like to ask the folks who've been doing all the heavy lifting on this bill to join me up here, Anne and Bruce Pratt.
Okay.
And
good.
We've brought a couple of the folks that can be resources for you, Senator Minutes and Senator Burdick. Captain Chuck Hayes from the State Police can answer your questions regarding how we set up in the bill a specific fund earmarked specifically for DUII enforcement efforts. And how that will work and some of the issues that they're facing right now in that regard. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to have the sponsors
Where
come up
they?
And then...
There they are.
Ah.
You're so close, I can't see you.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, I'm Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for Representative Randy Miller, who is the chief sponsor for these bills and offered his services to help get these bills moving through the process. But really, the two people you see to my right have done the hard work on these, both victims of the tragedy that comes with drunk driving incidents. And I will be available for any follow-up questions or information and add some perspective after you've heard from some of the other folks if you have any other questions.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. and Mrs. Pratt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning.
Good.
My name is Bruce Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. As you know, driving under the influence is a tremendous problem in Oregon. In 2002, there were well over 10,000 DUI convictions and 12,000 diversion agreements. That same year, 200 people died at the hands of the intoxicated driver, and another 2,000 were injured. One in every 140 miles is driven by a drunk driver. They are killing legal, licensed, sober drivers and their passengers and pedestrians. Drivers, when they are stopped for probable cause, are asked to take a field sobriety test. Some of them refuse. Some also refuse, after they've been arrested, refuse the breathalyzer test. The officer then has to rely on other methods to prove the state's case. First offense refusal is now sanctioned with a one-year license suspension, and then there is a 90-day wait for a hardship permit. Since we decriminalized driving while suspended a few years ago, there is little incentive to take the breath test. Yet this test is the best evidence of guilt or innocence. Now, in 2002, there were 3,000 sanctions for refusal. With a fine of $500 to $1,000 for a refusal, they should have to consider their answer. And as mentioned earlier, this refusal is admissible at trial. Our research has found 10 other states that fine for refusal. Those fines ranging from $100 to a maximum of $50,000. Now, Oregon revised statutes state that driving in Oregon is a privilege and not a right. People who drink and drive are breaking the law and abusing that privilege. We are asking for sanctions that will reduce driving under the influence of intoxicants. Driving under the influence of intoxicants is the most often committed violent crime in Oregon. Lieutenant Dwayne Stanton, Oregon State Police Area Commander in Astoria, states that DUII is a crime committed by almost anyone, regardless of their social status, education, and race. It crosses all class lines. There is no real social barrier. We need to close the loopholes that allow drinking drivers to continue to threaten the legal and sober drivers of our state. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Ann Pratt. I'm from Lane County. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Parents of Murdered Children. First of all, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak to you today and for hearing our bills. I am the mother of a DUI fatality. My son was youngest son was killed by a drunk driver in 1998 by a man with a 0.9 BAC level. I believe that we all need to abide by the laws of our state of Oregon, not just some of us. And every year, those over 3,000 offenders who 3,000 offenders who refuse a breathalyzer or intoxilizer test by a member of law enforcement, and our implied consent law of our state enables that officer to ask that motorist to submit to that test under probable cause. If I were stopped and I'd been drinking, I can only think of a couple reasons why I would refuse. I might be found guilty of being legally intoxicated and guilty if I blew a 0.08 or over, or possibly I'd been down that road before. I'm told that prosecutors can and do prosecute these offenders, but refusals are much harder to prove and very time-consuming, and time equates to dollars in our court systems. I would like to submit for the record a testimony from a man, Buffalo Zobel, who is a good example of a victim of one of these individuals. Buffalo Zobel was a runner trained for the Portland Marathon in 2000 when he was struck down by a man, Timothy Soldoni, from behind. He was actually jogging on the correct side of the road. The man crossed over. It was at 7:15 in the morning. He had been out. The driver had been out partying with friends the night before. This is an individual who had refused a breath test in the past, had several convictions, and those two were pending while when he hit Mr. Zobel. At that time, he also refused a breath test and did a forced blood draw at the hospital. This is what Mr. Zobel has to say. In my case, he was apprehended in Lake Oswego shortly after he hit me, but he refused a breath test at the scene. It was 3 hours later when he was forced to give a blood sample for VAC. It was 0.13, but it was estimated to be at least 0.17 at the time of impact. I spoke with Mr. Zobel this week. He is grateful to be alive. He is grateful he can even walk, and this is what happened to him that morning. The hit and run crash broke both my legs, fractured a bone in his lower back, separated his shoulder, left him with severe facial injuries, and required skin grafts and plastic surgery. He was wearing reflective jogging gear, running against traffic, and was off the roadway. The driver actually had to cross the double yellow line to strike him from behind. Soldoni was sentenced to eight years and 3 months in prison for multiple convictions. But Buffalo Zobel has been sentenced to a lifetime of pain and disability. He says, "I believe the system failed in this case. We must strengthen our laws to prevent the first time and repeat offenders." I have several other cases listed on my sheet. I'm not going to go through them. A couple of them are pending. There was one in Wasco County where this person has 17 DUI arrests. He refused everything. He's a diabetic person. He weighs 300 pounds. Hard for law enforcement to handle when they do pick him up. And they say he is a mean drunk. There was a case in Deschutes County where John Alton Thomas was cruising along in his rig with his half case of beer, ran through a construction zone, hit one of the flaggers, nearly severing his leg. He continued on until he was boxed in by construction equipment and angry construction workers. He also had a history of refusal. I've asked myself, and I'm sure that they would ask themselves, how would this law define a refusal change things? And, you know, I became the queen of what ifs after my son was killed, and I realized you can't change the past. You have to live for today, and you have to work towards changing the future. And we all know that one change in events can rewrite history. We believe this would provide incentive for that offender to blow. The purpose of House Bill 2900 is very simple. It's to get at the truth by prompting the DUI offenders to blow, identifying them, and getting them off our roads. It's about reducing the threat of hundreds of intoxicated drivers who are using our roadways on a daily basis. We need all the tools and resources possible to accomplish this. The added bonus in this bill is the extra revenue, which we have requested part of it be designated to the Oregon State DUI Enforcement Program. I also want to tell you that Crime Victims United, Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Parents of Murdered Children support this bill. House Bill 2900 is about responsibility, accountability, and public safety. Please pass House Bill 2900. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions? Senator Burdick.
Just one question. What state has a $50,000 fine for...
Alaska.
Alaska.
Senator Burdick, Alaska.
Okay. All right, any other questions? There are no other questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We've got Janet Lovelace. Lovelace.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, my name is Janet Lovelace. I live in Eugene, Oregon. This Monday is June 9th. It will be 3 years since I've last seen my daughter. Nothing's going to change what has happened in my case, but I believe these bills and other DUII bills can help make a difference. I will make this very short. I know that I believe that everyone understands the dangers of drinking and driving. Regarding House Bill 2900, frankly, I really wouldn't even be here if the drunk driver just went out and killed himself. But somehow it never seems to work out like that. And a lot of innocent victims, families, loved ones, people minding their own business, coming home from work, going to the soccer game, going to the movies, whatever, they're the ones that are getting struck. They're the ones that are suffering the losses and the pain. 2900 as 2901, both of those bills will send that message. We've got to continue to make it so uncomfortable, so that these people that choose to drink and drive will not do it, that they'll stop, they'll think, they will be understanding that there are real consequences, that the state of Oregon has gotten tough on DUI. One more point I'd like to make. I do believe that citizens over the age of 21 do have the right to consume alcoholic beverages, but they do not have the right to drink and drive. I just believe that with the continued message sent through the elected officials in the state of Oregon, that they can finally send the clear message that this is not going to be tolerated and that enough is enough. And so I just urge you all, please, to vote House Bill 2900 and 2901 with a due pass recommendation onto the Senate floor. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lovelace. Any questions? There are none. Thank you. Doug Harkle Road.
Chairman, if David Schwartz, the next one down there, could come up with me.
You bet.
He's a lawyer in our office. David will go first, if that's all right, and I'll bet.
Yes, sir.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for giving us this time. I am a deputy district attorney in Lane County. I prosecute, I charge about 800 new cases a year. Several hundred of those cases are DUI-related crimes, several of them involving crashes with injuries.
Could you do me a favor and just state your name for the record?
I apologize. Dave Schwartz.
Dave Schwartz, thank you. Should be obvious, but
no, it's,
I've got the list. So.
Thank you. And I am here in support of both 2900 and 2901. Is from my perspective, they will contribute significantly to more effective enforcement of DUI-related crimes. First of all, in 2900, probably the best evidence of intoxication, obviously, is the blood alcohol content. The only practical way for us to get that evidence is through the breath test in almost all DUI cases. There are incidents where there's a homicide or major injury where medical professionals will be called in for search warrant execution or probable cause plus exit circumstances, blood draws, but that is simply not practical in most DUI cases, and so we rely on this breath test to get the best evidence of intoxication. Every driver, obviously, in Oregon has consented to take the breath test as a matter of law under implied consent law. However, that doesn't prevent a substantial number of people who are suspected of being under the influence from refusing to take the test that they have consented to under law. And that is a problem for enforcement. As I understand it, looking through the numbers, there are several thousand people that refuse to take the breath test each year in Oregon. And so every incentive that we have to take the breath test helps. We do have the current incentive of an enhanced suspension period for those who refuse to take the breath test. But that clearly is not enough because several continue to refuse. This bill is a win-win situation because you're going to have one of two outcomes. You're either going to have a suspected DUI driver who's been arrested take the test, the would-be refusal, or the would-be refuser of the breath test take the test because of this additional penalty with a $500 to $1,000 fine that they'd be informed of, which is great for enforcement because it makes a stronger case for the state. It also will save money for the state and local courts as less of these cases will go forward in the process. In my experience, these refusals go to trial at a much higher rate than the DUI cases where there is a blood alcohol content. The other alternative is that they continue to refuse despite the enhanced fine, which incidentally raises money for the state, specifically for the state police to contribute to DUI enforcement. But it also gives me as a prosecutor an additional tool for trial because I think that a jury is going to understand quickly and clearly what it means when somebody was willing to pay $500 to $1,000 to conceal blood alcohol content. Furthermore, there's one more remark I have about this particular bill. I think it there's some fairness issue that deserves to be commended regarding this bill. A lot of the DUI legislation that you all see involves enhanced penalties that apply across the board to anybody who's convicted of DUI. But this bill in particular, actually, and since it only punishes those who are refusing to do what they're supposed to do in the first place, which is take the breath test. And so I think that that's something that's commendable about the bill, and I urge its passage. As for a 2901, if it pleases the members, I'll go ahead and make my comments on 2901 now. Most of us assume, and Ms. Lovelace just stated, that everyone knows the dangers of drinking and driving. One of the problems with that assumption, I think it's correct, everyone does know the dangers, but few people are going to admit that they're the one who's going to pose the danger to others when they drink and drive. And we encounter that time and time again. And though we have this assumption that everyone knows this, there's still a substantial amount of money spent on public awareness campaigns. Billboards, television, and radio, and all these things I think are necessary and they're good and commendable because they do contribute to that culture of awareness of these risks. But those hinge on the audience's reception of those messages. And in a sense, it's really a unilateral communication, and we hope that people pick up the message. The thing that I think is special about this bill is that it's a two-way street. We have anybody who's going to apply for a license has to sign an acknowledgement of those risks, and furthermore has to promise not to engage in the risks of driving under the influence of intoxicants. And that's what I think is special about this bill, and that it is a two-way street. And I really like the idea that every 16-year-old that goes and applies for their license has to acknowledge the risks and promise not to do what is probably, statistically speaking, the most dangerous thing for people of that person's age to do, which is drink and drive. Thank you.
All right, since I have a couple of prosecutors here, tell me, with respect to 2901, assuming that this became law, what value does it have, if any, to a prosecution?
Chairman, it's Doug Harkle, wrote for the record, the district attorney in Lane County. And I suspect that a prosecutor and one of our prosecutors, David Bill, testified on the House side that we would try to get that into evidence in a vehicular crash case where somebody is injured or killed and alcohol is involved, to show the reckless behavior that they knew of the risk and they disregarded the risk.
Right, you said,
so I suspect prosecutors would try to use that.
Right, you said they would try to use it. What barriers do you see to the admission of this as evidence?
Right now, I don't see any barrier. It seems to me that if I personally signed a document that I acknowledge that I know something, that the court's going to let it in. It's just that we haven't litigated that issue yet, and I'm sure there will be some of our creative defense attorneys will come up with some arguments against it. But I think it probably comes in.
That was my next question, but I'll ask the defense.
Ask them what their argument would be. I think it comes in.
Senator Brady.
I want to ask the converse of that. If someone, DMV is a pretty busy place, and if someone neglects to get the signature on this form, which is a new form, are you at all concerned that the defense can come in and say, and use that as a defense if the person did not sign this form?
No, I'm not. And the reason I'm not is because we don't have it now, and we do prosecute these cases now. This is just one little slice of evidence that we would offer in a manslaughter or negligent homicide case. It's not going to be the controlling fact, I don't think, and I've looked at these cases for many years and evaluated them for many years. It won't be the controlling fact as to whether or not we go forward. So it would just be one little additional piece of evidence that we would be offering.
All right. And as far as DUI prosecutions today, is there a mental intent necessary to prove?
No, not for DUII. I was talking about manslaughter cases or negligent homicide cases or serious assault cases where there is a mental element that's required. But for the standard DUII case...
Right, you just need to prove the BAC and the driving.
Yeah, this isn't going to come in. There's not going to be a need for it.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
I did have one thing,
yes,
if
sir.
I might. I was just answering questions there. Doug Harkle wrote for the record.
Oh, I thought you were.
Chair Menas, members of the committee.
Go ahead,
sir.
Go ahead.
What I wanted to say is that two things. One, to reiterate, the Oregon District Attorney's Association supports both of these bills. And two is that since I've been doing this work since 1974, we have seen significant change in Oregon in the attitude towards drunk driving or driving under the influence. A lot of that comes from the legislation which this body has passed over the years. These are two more pieces. The problem, of course, as we all know, has not gone away. These are two more small pieces, but significant pieces, in continuing to send that message out that drinking and driving doesn't work because it hurts and kills people. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right, we have, I think, Matt Meter from Donna Nelson's office. Okay, Donna Nelson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Matt Meter. I work for Representative Donna Nelson, who is a strong supporter of House Bills 2900 and 2901. And today I will present her testimony briefly to the committee. She is not here, obviously, this morning. I'm no representative, Donna Nelson, so...
But you do know her, right?
I do know her. Rather fond of her. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary, we thank you today for your consideration of House Bills 2900 and 2901. Oregon has a serious problem with drivers who drink and decide to drive. In 2002, 39% of all Oregon traffic fatalities were alcohol-related. In 1999, 36.5% of all Oregonians ages 15 to 20 who were killed in traffic accidents were killed at the hands of drunk drivers. Laboratory and on-road research demonstrates that the vast majority of drivers, even experienced drivers, are significantly impaired with a blood alcohol content of 0.08, the legal point of impairment to operate a motor vehicle in our great state. This impairment extends to critical driving tasks such as braking, steering, lane changing, judgment, and divided attention. The Yamhill County Sheriff's Office in our district arrested 165 drunk drivers in 2001 and 155 in 2002. The Sheriff's Office arrested 43 drunk drivers in 2001 to 2002 as part of a DUII enforcement grant program that tracked blood alcohol content. Of those 43 arrests, 9 refused to submit to breathalyzer tests. That's over 20%. Statewide, approximately 12% of drivers refused breath tests at time of arrest. House Bills 2900 and 2901 are beneficial tools that law enforcement may use to help curb the devastating problem of drunk driving in Oregon. House Bill 2900 addresses those drivers suspected of drunk driving who decline to submit to breathalyzer tests, and House Bill 2901 requires potential drivers to acknowledge the dangers of driving under the influence of intoxicants and to agree not to do so. Chairman, members of the committee, on behalf of Representative Nelson, I urge your support of both of these bills.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Metter? Brennan? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Chuck Hayes, Oregon State Police. And now, I don't have anyone signed up from the defense bar. Did you want to sign up? No. Okay. You chicken? No, it's not. Sorry. I know.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Captain Chuck Hayes, the director of the Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division, and I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 2900, which addresses the refusal of the intoxilizer test. A lot of discussion regarding breathalyzer, but just for the record, we use intoxilizers in the state of Oregon, have for about 15 years. There are actually no breathalyzers in Oregon any longer. The intoxilizer phased out the breathalyzers about the mid-1980s. I'm here in support of this bill. Obviously, the Oregon State Police has gone through a lot of reduced funding issues lately. The Oregon State Police Implied Consent Unit maintains approximately 150 intoxilizers statewide. They are purchased by the Oregon State Police and maintained by the Oregon State Police. We had a unit that was about 6 people that were taking care of that statewide. With the reductions that we've gone through, now we're down to 2 people that maintain the intoxilizers throughout the state of Oregon. So if there's an intoxilizer at the Portland Police Bureau or at the Klamath Falls County Jail in Klamath County, that intoxilizer is maintained by the Oregon State Police and our implied consent unit. And in fact, this morning, Jeff Rost, who is the director of our implied consent unit, he is in Coos Bay attending a trial there, and he is providing expert courtroom testimony about the intoxilizer. So when an issue comes up in a trial regarding the intoxilizer and the maintenance of that instrument and the effects of that instrument and how it works, well, then our implied consent people respond to those subpoenas, so he could not be here today. So with 150 intoxilizers and many cases and many issues that we have come up in court, this keeps this unit very busy. So we see this as a possible funding source that would help us to maintain the implied consent unit and also to be able to provide that service not only for the Oregon State Police but for city and county law enforcement as well. Because without the intoxilizers and obviously without maintaining those instruments and keeping those instruments up and running, that is going to create a burden on law enforcement, also on our prosecutors, because without those instruments being maintained, that would be a loophole in the law that obviously would be in favor of the defendant. We see that this could generate approximately $700,000 per year. It takes about $875,000 a year to maintain our implied consent unit with the Oregon State Police. So this is definitely something that would help keep this program going. It's a program that, must continue on. The Oregon State Police is already looking at maybe eliminating some of the intoxilizers statewide because we just don't have the funding or the personnel to maintain that program. So this could be used in that area. It also could be used as far as DUII enforcement. You heard testimony earlier about how much the Oregon State Police receives and other law enforcement agencies receive to do overtime enforcement or special enforcement efforts for DUII. So again, any funds that would be generated as a result of House Bill 2900 could be applied in that area that would help us to reduce DUII and obviously have an impact on the injuries and crashes and deaths that are a result of driving while impaired. So that concludes my testimony, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer those.
Okay. Senator Warren.
Thank you. You indicate, sir, that this could bring in $700,000 a year. Is that because you think people are still going to refuse to take the test and then they'll just be fined?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I'm basing that on what we have seen in the past couple of years as far as refusals. I personally think that if this law is enacted, that we will see less refusals. So we could be actually looking at the high end of that. I can tell you from personal experience of arresting people that are suspended or were suspended at the time of the arrest, many of those suspects or defendants at that time basically said, why would I want to take the intoxilizer or the breath test because I'm suspended now? So now if there is an additional criminal charge and the possibility of a fine like this that is proposed with this legislation, I think you'll see more people that will actually be taking the breath test when requested to do so.
Well, I would agree. I think people are going to take the breath test more often because if one thing is sure, money's important to people, whether driving drunk isn't or not. But it isn't creating a new crime. It's just stating you can be fined for that. So
yes.
I think that's probably going to be the motivating factor.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I agree. I think this would be a motivating factor, and I think that's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. If we don't generate approximately $700,000, well, then actually we have succeeded because what we want to try to do is to get people to take a breath test when they're suspected of driving under the influence, and hopefully this House Bill 2900 will do that.
And it doesn't indicate, Mr. Chair, if I could continue, it doesn't indicate in the bill why a fine would be imposed of $500 to $1,000. It just says that's the low amount and this is the high amount. So I guess it depends on the mood of the judge that day or the police officer. Who's going to impose the fine?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, that would be up to the judge.
Okay. So it just depends on your mood that day.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that could be correct. It will vary from judge to judge, county to county, jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Okay. So there I actually work for federal judges and they're not as moody as other judges.
Oh yeah, right.
Because I have them well trained.
For the record, I would prefer not to comment about the moods of judges because I have to appear in court quite often.
That would be a good thing. And I'll probably be in trouble next time I am court reporting in front of one of them. But they forget that court reporters need to use the restroom. That's the problem. But there are no criteria for, like, if this is your second offense, you're going to get a fine of $1,000 or $500. So it's just...
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there is not.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, and actually, on that point, there doesn't seem to be any provision for persons who cannot pay.
Persons who are what?
The persons who cannot pay.
Right.
I'm not sure what happens in that instance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it would be dealt with like any case. I think to answer the questions Senator Walker raised, a cynical approach is that it would be on the mood of the judge, and I definitely have seen that affect fines. But also, I would assume it would take into effect the take into account the driving record of the person, and maybe I've seen them also take into account the BAC level, how intoxicated the person was. As far as the fines that are levied, in my experience, when there is a base amount of fine, some judges will try to suspend a part of the fine. Some judges, I've even seen, bargain and say you can do X amount of community service, things like that. But I think in a case like this where there's a minimum fine, they would probably look at imposing the minimum and then setting a payment plan. And if that didn't work, you know, there's always, you could always go to the Department of Revenue to be, you know, there's a lot of, I guess what I'm saying is there's a lot of traffic fines out there that aren't paid. And, you know, the courts try to deal with them in other ways. There's also, I think, a mechanism for maybe getting your license suspended if you don't pay some of your fines. So I'd have to look at all the scenarios.
Right. Sure. Senator Burdick.
The fines are earmarked for this drunk driving account, which I assume... It seemed to indicate here in the bill that ORS 181.175, this account already exists in the department.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yeah, I believe that is correct.
Okay, and so are you speaking for the whole department today, that in other words, the whole department of state police is comfortable with this revenue going into this one particular fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, I am speaking for the Oregon State Police. We have discussed this, and we do believe that this account that is set up, we could be able to earmark funds appropriately, whether it be to assist with this breath testing unit or actual enforcement as well. So there, I am speaking for the agency.
Okay. And finally, Mr. Chairman, would there be any extra administrative costs from earmarking this money? Normally it goes into the unitary fund, and there's a whole administrative setup around that. But by earmarking this revenue stream for this one purpose, are there any administrative costs associated with that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I am not aware of any administrative costs that would be associated with this. From the unitary assessment, as you're speaking, we would have to look at that because, yes, that there may be some unitary assessment application with the fines that are generated from this as well. But I do not see any administrative costs within our agency, if that's what you're speaking of, as the way that the funds would be earmarked and generated to the Oregon State Police and then other agencies. Is Kelly Taylor still here? What do you think about this? Or are you here for another bill?
No, I'm not.
All right. You didn't sign up, but your presence always startles me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. Certainly don't need to startle you, Mr. Chair. I just was here in case you had any questions.
We always have bad news. It's like, this thing's going to cost $1 billion or something. So.
Actually, Mr. Chair, this bill is about $80,000.
Which bill?
2901, excuse me. And it's just, you know, it's a little bit of increase of workload. That's what that $80,000 is. It's because of the, you know, the just the sheer volume of transactions. Having an additional statement for someone to have to sign, there will be some number of people that want to discuss it with you and ask, well, what does this mean? And, you know, you say, well, it means what it says, and, well, what if I don't sign it? Well, then you don't get your license. You know, there will be some discussions about it out in the field offices.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question, and I have to go to a conference committee. You said this is $80,000?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, yeah, it's about $85,000.
Did this bill go to Ways and Means? Because it's my understanding the rules say that it goes to Ways and Means if it's over $49,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, this bill
does
not go to Ways and
Means.
Okay.
Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, by the way, I don't know if there is there a fiscal officer in the House? If not, do we have a... Okay. This issue was raised in the House, and the I have the fiscal office's write-up on this, and they... I'll read the pertinent part. The cost of this one position, meaning the one that Kelly just mentioned for a full biennium is $81,024. Given that the DMV maintains 64 field offices, the Legislative Fiscal Office believes that this level of additional staff support could be absorbed within existing resources. To the extent this bill generates a workload beyond the capacity of existing DMV staff, there may be need for additional limitation and position authority. That discussion was brought up, and the idea was that there will not be a funding for this, that it will be absorbed within DMV.
Are you saying something different today in the analysis?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm just responding to the question.
But the assumption is that you'll absorb it within
right.
the agency budget. You didn't say that.
Well, I don't know what all bills will pass and what will be absorbed and what won't. The last sentence is, to the extent it can't, then we come back to the limitation authority. So,
okay. All right.
I know that in the budget and DMV there's 30 positions being cut, and then maybe additional 10. Don't know what all bills are going to pass, so we don't know what we can absorb, what we can't at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Kelly.
You bet.
All right. That's about it. Anybody else wishing to testify on either 2900 or 2901? If not, we're going to close the public hearings on those bills, and we're not going to move the bills today. Hold on to these for a little bit, and we're going to move on to a couple of other bills. To public hearing 3385. We're going to be in, we're suspended animation for just a second. We're going to change counsel here. Richard Vile or Rich Vile? Are you here?
He's not here.
David, why don't you come up and... Are you guys going to testify together?
We are.
Okay.
We're going to ask questions and have questions by you together.
3385. Condominium law.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Bennett. Rich Vile and I are members of the Oregon State Bar. We've been on this committee for the last, I've been on it for 30 years. He's been on it for 20 years, suggesting amendments to the Condominium Act, and after the Planned Community Act came into existence in 1981, suggesting amendments to that. He and I both represent developers, associations, individuals, work with managers. On our committee are managers, accountants, consultants who have looked at the aspects of the Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act, and over the past many years, to suggest amendments which we believe make everything more workable for all those parties involved in this area of the law. We also are members of Community Associations Institute, which is a national organization having to do with community associations nationally. Both Rich and I have spoken at the national seminars on these things, as well as being educated there. Community Association Institute had some members in addition to us on this committee. That we have provided some written testimony to you and a summary of what the Act does. I believe there are some hand-engrossed changes to the aid-engrossed bill. I think those have been provided to you. Many of those came from comments from Gene Grant, who is also a lawyer who hadn't had an opportunity to review it thoroughly and made some changes, most of which simply relate to some references that didn't work very well. Two of the suggested changes that Gene Grant has made relate to what can be discussed in the executive committee. And we thought that it is important from time to time to have executive sessions at the board of directors, but we wanted to limit that to the extent possible, and so we've withdrawn suggestion with respect to two of those pieces, that, for example, litigation cannot be discussed in executive session unless it's discussed with counsel. So in addition to some housekeeping issues and cleaning up some things, making some things easier for the association to operate, requiring a little more clarity in the declarations with respect to the reserved rights of the declarant, and then there's a special section at the end with respect to leasehold condominiums, which I wrote. If you have questions about that, it's it more easily facilitates the conversion of a leasehold condominium to a fee condominium, and there were some problems with respect to that because of financing on leasehold condominiums that are less than 30 years remaining in the lease. And so we've provided an easier way to do that. In some instances, there's rights of first refusal to buy the leasehold underlying individual condominium units, and we needed a mechanism to subject the fee to the condominium form of ownership and at the same time keep all the liens of the lenders and the other parties in the same priority.
Right.
So if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I understand this bill clearly is not ready to move today. So
I understand that that's correct because the hand and gross things weren't prepared by legislative council yet, I believe,
right.
Reviewed by them. But we wanted to come down and make sure we answered any questions that you might have.
Right. Sir?
Rich Vile. I'm that condominium working group.
Okay, good. All right. Any additional testimony?
No.
None? Zip? Okay. Any questions by the committee? I think we'll obviously have some time to read through this thing. It looks to me like a work product of a lot of time and energy.
Chairman, members of the committee, one thing I would say that as you read through it, everything is written twice because you have the Planned Community Act and then you have the Condominium Act. So every time you read the Planned Community Act, later in the bill you'll see the Planned Community or the Condominium Act, exactly the same provisions. Homeowner associations work the same way in both types of communities. So it's double the size that it probably needs to be, but there are two statutes that have exactly the same thing mirrored
right.
into them.
It seems like every session we're dealing with some form of condominium law or something. It's just like,
well, there's more and more people live in homeowner associations now, so it's becoming increasingly important to their lifestyle.
And Chairman, as members of the committee, the little amendments that you see actually came from Mayor Gene Grant of Happy Valley. And Happy Valley is a good example. That's a little community that had a few hundred people in it a few years ago. Because of the urban growth boundary, they've got tens of thousands now, and virtually everyone lives in a planned community or a condominium because everything's being built in one of those two types of products.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Kelly, thank you very much.
Comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was obviously a large work product, and there were certain amendments on the House side to make it a little smoother, and it's these amendments I understand are already with LC, are being drafted, the ones that you see in the Hand of Growth version, and should be ready, if not later this week, first thing next week.
All right. So we'll bring it back when we have all of the amendments and everybody's on board and holding hands and happy. Okay? Close the public hearing unless there's someone else wishing to testify. Except, no? None? Okay. We're done with that puppy. Three to a 5 minute recess.
Now Ted's here.
Mr. Chairman.
Hearing on House Bill 2080. Council, you want to?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2080 deals with a statute of limitations for product liability cases, and it's actually not quite as simple of a bill as it appears. In product liability cases, there's a question as to when the statute of limitation runs. Does it run upon the date the damage actually happens, or does it run upon the date that there is a discovery by the claimant of a link between the product liability and the damage itself, be it a death, an injury, property damage? And what this bill is trying to do essentially is to reinstate this so-called discovery rule. And what that means is that if you are damaged by a defective product and the defect in the product is not obvious from the product itself, you may not know that the damage you're experiencing, be it an injury, is related to the product. I could think of an example of the, if you had a watch that had the glow-in-the-dark stuff on it, that stuff used to actually be made out of radium. And let's say you have a rash on your wrist, you wouldn't know. You could have had it for 2 years and not realize that it's related to the radium in your watch. Would the statute of limitations start to run when the rash appeared on your wrist, or would it start to run when you realize that there's radium in your watch and you linked it to your wrist? This bill is essentially reinstating the discovery rule, and the proponents will come up and describe a series of cases that Oregon courts have discussed where it's kind of gone back and forth on is there or is there not a discovery rule. If there's not a discovery rule and you had this rash on your wrist for 2 years, or whatever, and assuming the statute of limitations was 2 years, and then finally at 2 years and 1 day you realize your watch had radium in it, you could no longer bring a claim against the manufacturer for the rash because the date has passed, even though you were unaware of the link. And that's what this bill essentially deals with.
All right. Thank you very much. Who is on our list to testify?
Richard Lane and Jim Gardner.
Richard Lane and Jim Gardner. You guys like the Battle of the Titans.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the OTLA, and I'm here in support of 2080. And as the chair just mentioned, Mr. Gardner is also here. 2080 A in gross is the product of both of the parties here before you's work. I'll go through the bill and the reason why we need the bill in a second, but I do want to make clear that Section 1 and Section 2, as you look at it, is a product of an awful lot of work on both sides and a compromised position that was passed out of House Judiciary and passed the House side 56 to nothing. Before reaching you people's desk. The bill, why are we here? In 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court rendered an opinion called Gladhart versus Oregon Vineyards. And the Gladhart case involved a winery. They had purchased some wine stems for growing in the fields, and when they purchased those wine stems, this was in Yamhill County, I believe, when they purchased it, there was a microscopic bug on the vine stems, phylloxera or something. Nobody knew it at the time it was purchased. They planted the stems, as you'd expect. They worked the fields, and some 4 years after they had purchased the vine stems, it was discovered that all of the vines that were now in the fields were being eaten away and were a complete loss. The Gladhart family filed an action, and an argument was made that they were time-barred in pursuing their case because their injury happened at the time that they purchased the vine stems. Even though they didn't know about the bug, even though they didn't know that they had suffered any harm, even though that the harm and the loss of the crop wasn't going to be revealed until some 4 years down the road from the date of purchase. That case moved its way through the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, applying a strict construction of the product liability statute, under a case called PGE versus Moley, said that the clear language in the products liability statute says that you must bring a products liability action within 2 years of the date you were injured. Since you were injured at the time you bought the bug-infested vineyards, your claim was barred and you were out of court. Now that case, Gladhart, and its strict construction of the products liability statute was a surprise. Mr. Gardner and I could go back and forth for hours about how much of a surprise it was, but it took everybody in the legal community quite aback. There were a number of cases prior to PG versus Bully that had indicated, if not so held, that there was a discovery statute in connection with the product liability statute, that you didn't have to bring your action, file in court, until you knew three elements: that you were harmed, who caused your harm, and the harm was based upon negligent conduct. That had been law, at least it was believed to be law prior to Gladhart. It clearly is not after Gladhart. So 2080 just returns everybody back to the status quo prior to Gladhart. Section 1 now outlines what an individual has to know in order to have the clock start running. And Section 2, which we'll talk about in a minute, just has the application of Section 1. And I repeat, Mr. Gardner and I have no objection to any part of Section 1 as a correct restatement of the law for Oregon. As an aside, there is one other portion of Section 1, again, that everybody agrees to. It was a case called Cambury, and this was a rollover death case, products case. We have a three-year wrongful death statute under 30.020. The products liability statute says you must bring an action within 2 years, as we just talked about in Gladhart. In Cambury, the Oregon Supreme Court said that a death case, even though we have a three-year death statute, if it's arising from an injury caused by a product, you must bring it within 2 years. So Section 1 of House Bill 2080 corrects that and says if you have a product liability death case, that's a three-year statute under ORS 30.020, just like every other death case. Again, no questions, no disagreement among the parties concerned with this bill regarding that change. Section 2 of the bill is the application portion of the bill. And as the committee can see, sub 1 of Section 2 indicates that the amendments apply to injuries or damage that occur after the effective date, a prospective application. But then subsection 2 goes on to talk about those people who have been prejudiced based upon the change in the law by the Oregon Supreme Court. The Gladharts, if I could return to them, their case was adjudicated out. They have exhausted all their remedies, and they were thrown out of court based upon this change in the law. Subsection 2 of Section 2 would allow a party who has been adjudicated out because of the Gladhart case 1 year to refile an action. So we have two classes of cases being taken care of in Section 2. Those people in the future, they get a discovery rule just like we all thought there was one. Those in the past that have been adjudicated out based upon Gladhart, they have 1 year to refile their claims. Now, what's missing from Section 2, and it was recognized on the House side, is a third class of cases impacted by this bill. And that's a class of cases that were filed but has not been adjudicated out as yet, as we sit here today. Under that circumstance, the amendments, as drafted, would have no effect on those pending cases because they're in the system, they haven't been adjudicated out. And we have submitted a proposed language, we don't have it here today, I understand it's being taken care of, that would make the amendments apply to pending cases as well. The alternative, if that amendment or some form of that amendment is not adopted, the alternative is anybody who's in the system right now could move affirmatively to have their case adjudicated out. And then they'd have 1 year to file the case again, which from my perspective seems to be a costly, time-consuming, and burdensome application on the court system. If they're just going to be back in front of you based upon the amendments that we all agree correctly restate the law, Why don't we take care of those pending cases while we have the opportunity?
Senator Brink.
What about cases where somebody discovers an injury maybe 2 months ago and is just about to file suit?
Senator Burdick, Senator Minnis, members of the committee, as a result of trying to reach a consensus agreement on the bill, HB 2080, that you have in front of you, I think all parties agree that some individuals will be left out. And under your hypothetical, the amendments would not apply to that person who knows that they have been injured. And that's just the nature of the compromise that was created as a result of the work on the House side.
And to follow up,
sure.
Would such a person, if they saw this bill coming and or maybe the bill was already in effect and they filed suit, then could they kick in under the amendment that you propose, or they would then become pending litigation?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, if somebody has already realized they've been injured, it would depend on the date that they were injured. If you were injured a month ago, hypothetically, and you know that somebody caused you harm, and you know it was a result of negligent conduct, then even under Gladhart, you would still have 1 year, 11 months in which to file a claim.
Well, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about cases that this is meant to address where the injury might have occurred some time ago, more than 2 years ago, that say you just discovered the injury. So you're a Gladhart type of person. You just haven't sued, you know, brought suit yet. So if this bill were enacted, could you bring suit and then fall under its protections?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you were injured more than 2 years ago, I think Gladhart bars your case, and these amendments do not resurrect such a claim as drafted.
If you see what I'm saying here, if you have your amendment to wrap in pending litigation, couldn't they get wrapped in by filing suit, and then they would be pending litigation?
Senator Burdick, if a person who's not filed, that has been injured, had been injured more than 2 years ago, and then became aware that this became law, could they then file a case, be considered a pending case, and then be able to adjudicate out? I believe that that might be a possibility. I just think as a practical matter, that's an unlikely scenario, because the person would have to be up to speed, and then between the time that this bill becomes law, I don't see that there's a window of opportunity to get the case investigated, to get the case filed, to get the necessary adjudication of dismissal out in which to take advantage of the one-year refiling. So as a practical matter, I don't see that scenario. But is that a possibility? Yes.
Well, but the amendment that you just described that we don't have in front of us is to allow people who are now in court to not have to adjudicate out. In other words, they stop the process and can take advantage of that year without going through to the end. What I'm saying is if someone has been injured but has not yet filed suit, if they start a lawsuit, can they fall under that exemption?
Senator Burke, members of the committee, I would agree that somebody who is not in the system now, who filed tomorrow, might be able to take advantage of that amendment, depending upon the timing and the ability to file a case tomorrow, and then go through all of the procedural mechanisms in place to get it adjudicated out at the time that the bill became law. I just don't see as a practical matter that the window allows that possible scenario.
Okay, Kelsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Richard, I have a question for you. I'm just rereading. If you go to Section 2, Line 12, which is Section 2, Sub 2, little c,
It says a final judgment was entered in the civil action on or after June 8, 2001, which I assume was the date of the Gladhart decision.
That's correct.
Okay. And before the effective date of this act. So I'm not reading this, now that I've reread this, I'm not reading this to say that somebody who is in the system now, this act gets passed, they could dismiss their case and refile because the final judgment in a case like that wouldn't be entered before the effective date of this act. In other words, if we pass this act, somebody who's in the system now who hasn't gotten dismissed and gotten a final judgment, they're just going to be going on the norm, on the current law as it stands before passing this act. Am I wrong in that?
I think that's a correct analysis.
Okay, so what Senator Burdick is talking about and what you and I and Jim talked about before about trying to rope in these people who are currently pending, this language with the sub C here is not going to work unless the proposed amendment that you're talking about will completely replace Section 2.
Sub 2 of Section 2?
No, Section 2. All of it would have to go. Because if you have, if, as I'm reading it now, as the law states, anybody in litigation right now, mm-hmm. unless they get dismissed within the next couple weeks, assuming we pass the measure as it is, they will not be able to dismiss an action and refile it after this measure passes to take advantage of any kind of change in the law. They were going under the current law, and the example that Senator Burdick brings forward, people who bring an action, see this law coming, bring an action, they'll have to have that action dismissed before we pass this measure.
Yes, I would agree, and if I was misstating our position, that would have to take place before the effective date, which is why I think it's an unpracticable scenario that somebody could get in the system and out of the system to take advantage of that.
Well, but that assumes that the amendment, Mr. Chairman, the amendment that you talked about before has not been put in.
The amendment I was proposing would be included in Section 2, Subsection 1, which would then say that the amendments apply only to debts, personal injury, or property damage that occur on or after the effective date. That would be future cases. And then I would add a clause that would say N cases pending, so that they would not have to go through the hoops of an adjudication out under Sub 2 of Section 2. So it would capture a pending case right now. I was under the belief that Sub 2 of Section 2 that we were just focusing on would only be applicable to those people that are out of the system completely. They would have been a final judgment had been entered on or after the date of the Gladhart and before the effective date of the act. They would get the 1 year.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the committee because I do have a copy of the amendments here, and I'm hoping that stack of paper sitting in front of you, Richard, is other copies of the amendments.
It's actually all the dashes all the way through.
Okay. I will make a copy of these for the committee.
No, I do have.
You do have
copies.
Just
the file is more than you can just
the copy. So that we're all on the same page here. But obviously the question that these gentlemen are discussing that's before the committee not only is the merits of the bill itself, but what do we do for people who are currently in litigation, have not been dismissed, or for people who have not filed litigation at all. That's not something addressed by the amendments, but that's another question.
All right. Richard, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Gardner, you've been patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the Gardner & Gardner Law Firm, and I'm appearing here today for several clients, including Pharma, Philip Morris, Kraft, and others. I would agree that what you have in front of you was the product of a lot of work and I think very careful and deliberate compromise on the part of both sides to this controversy, and I would commend the OTLA folks for working very hard on this with our people to try to come up with what we think is a reasonable compromise, which we would urge you to pass in its current form. Let me say simply by way of background that both the Gladhart decision and the Cambry decision were unanimous decisions by the Oregon Supreme Court, a court which is not known for its utterly pro-business reputation. Let me put it that way. It's a court that that looked very carefully at the indicia of legislative intent and the clear language of the statute. In one case, the statute of repose, statute of limitations applicable to product liability actions. In the other case, the interaction of the wrongful death statute and the statute of product liability statutes, and came out with unanimous decisions, two unanimous decisions, basically holding that the law means what it says with regard to the period of the statute of limitations, and it means what it says with regard to which of the two statutes, the product statute or the wrongful death statute, which prevails. Those decisions from the perspective of the defense community were favorable decisions. I think that one course of conduct might have been to simply try to stick strongly with those favorable decisions. However, there was a recognition by several of us and increasingly by a I think a consensus in the business community that there was some degree of potential unfairness in those opinions as they were articulated by the Supreme Court. That's certainly not a unanimous view in the business community, but there were some folks who felt that that was correct. As a result of that, we entered into a very lengthy, good faith set of negotiations with the OTLA folks, and what you see is the product of those negotiations. Now, when you change the law, what the normal rule is that you do it prospectively, and we are changing the law in two significant respects, both with regard to the wrongful death statute and with regard to the product statute. The normal rule is you do that prospectively, and one of the reasons you do that is because due process concerns are raised when you essentially revive claims that have gotten reposed, if you will, by virtue of an existing statute. Our preference would have been to make this law prospective only, purely prospective only, because that would have dealt with those due process, what I think you, Mr. Chair, called the ex post facto issue, would have dealt with it cleanly. However, at the specific request and direction of the House Chair, we agreed to the language that is now in Section 2. And it was the Chair's specific suggestion that we do the provision that conditions revival upon adjudication between the date of the Gladhart decision and the effective date of the 2003 Act. Now, this act does not have an emergency clause on it, and that means that the effective date is not going to be tomorrow or the date of passage. It's the normal effective date of any legislative act, which I believe, Mr. Chair, is January 1st of 2004. We would strongly oppose disturbing what we think was a good compromise on the House side, and I think that that would be the virtually unanimous view of the business community as well. I will say that that both sides, subsequent to the House discussion, did engage in some additional negotiations and exploration. Unfortunately, we were not able to come to a further liberalization, if you will, of this bill. But we would urge you to pass it as is.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Questions for Mr. Gardner, or Mr. Lane, or Senator Rendell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gardner, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on the circumstances that Richard Lane discussed where if you don't address pending claims, there's a way around it, and that is somebody can have the claim adjudicated. I mean, even a plaintiff could move to have their own case dismissed, and then that's going to trigger the statute, and whether essentially that kind of a plaintiff in that circumstance eventually gets what they want anyway, they just have to jump through a bunch of hoops to get there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't disagree that that's a possibility, and if to be very honest, if we sort of go down the route of opening it up further and installing what I think the amendment constitutes full retroactivity. I think that's the real effect of it. I would want to see if the bill were to move forward, it be changed back to what we originally preferred, which is purely prospective. But I don't disagree that there will be instances, and I think that was the House Chair's exact intent, was to have instances in which you could have revival of adjudicated out claims.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think somewhere in your answer you were agreeing that would be the effect of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, what could be as to certain cases? It's a more limited window than the proposed amendment would create.
I don't think that's inconsistent with what Richard Lane said earlier.
No, that's right. No, not correct. Mr. Chair, I guess my point is it seems a silly process for a plaintiff to have to go through to actually want their case to be dismissed so that then they can jump through another hoop and file again. Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, our preference would be for pure prospectivity, but in an effort to accommodate the specific direction of what the House Chair wanted to do, this is what we came up with.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Thank you. What is the term adjudicated out really mean? Does that mean you go through all the appeals? Or if it should be, I mean, what would happen if a plaintiff did move for dismissal? Would that be automatically granted?
I'll quickly address that. There was in the draft of this dash X, there was a provision that said that it had to be after all appeals, and we took that out on the House side. So it would be a final judgment pre-appeal.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I do not believe that it could be just a simple dismissal. That would not be an adjudication. In my mind, I'm envisioning sort of a motion for summary judgment that at the end of the resolution of a summary judgment motion is a judgment is entered on that claim or for that party. That would be the type of an adjudication that I think the Act contemplates.
All right.
But Mr. Chair, that would be a pre-appeal. We wouldn't, because we took out the appeal.
Okay. But could you see a situation where you could go into court and say, we've got this new bill, we want to move under this new bill, and we're asking for summary judgment so that we can do that? Do you expect that to happen?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't even know how many cases that we're actually talking about. And that sort of we both sides have tried to put a handle on that, and it's just impossible to do. I think it is available to a case. I'm just not sure how practical it is one way or the other, which is why we had suggested the pending type of things. We didn't have to do the whole adjudication out to take advantage of any of the amendments.
And Mr. Chair, that's why we suggested prospective only, because that also takes care of the problem in a very different way. But that's why we ended up with what we have on the House side.
All right. Thank you. I think the Chair's simple-minded approach, I happen to like the bright line approach, personally. That's just my view, simply because to do otherwise, I think, creates even more litigation trying to figure out who's in and who's out. That just kind of bothers me. I can't even figure out what the definition of adjudicated means or adjudicated out. So, we'll bring this back at some point. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we're going to try to do those people who have sat around and waited for 3329, I think given the time, we're not going to get to it. No one has come from more than 100 miles. Is there anybody on 3329 that cannot come back? All right. And we'll go to 3330, public hearing. One person signed up, Mr. Shepard.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I come before you to testify in support of Ian Gross House Bill 3330. This bill arises originally developed as a result of the review of Oregon law that Attorney General Myers conducted at the request of then Governor Kitzhaber following September 11th. The problem that the bill, as originally introduced, addressed was that a number of the victims of the attack in New York, particularly, were never located. Their bodies were never located. The families of those members had difficulty obtaining death certificates and determination that those individuals, in fact, had perished in that attack. And so New Jersey and other states enacted legislation to facilitate that process. And House Bill 3330 resulted from that problem. It was amended in the House to extend its reach to include natural disasters that have the same effect and to coordinate with elements of existing law. Briefly, what the bill does is establish a presumption that if a person was at or near a place that the governor has declared was a location at which there had been a natural disaster or a terrorist attack or an act of war that had caused the death of persons who were whose bodies were not found, and those people cannot be found as a result of diligent search. If those facts are proven, then the families of those victims would be entitled to obtain, in effect, a death certificate that would help them get things like insurance benefits and so forth. Two things that the bill does not do: does not apply in criminal cases, so this doesn't have any implications for a case in which a person is absent and a criminal charge may be considered or brought. And secondly, this bill doesn't have any effect on the further development of a peculiar doctrine of law called the special peril doctrine, which is a doctrine that common law courts have created to deal with some aspects of the same problem. And it's not clear whether Oregon courts yet recognize that doctrine, and the bill is expressly intended not to affect the further development of that. With that, I stand open for questions.
Pete, just one question I have is, in the instance that this occurred, and I assume this is going to be very rare, hopefully, and there's a declaration and a death certificate issued, what if the person suddenly reappears? And again, in the New York case, there were some folks that were deemed to be victims of that particular incident, but then later found. What happens in that instance?
Well, the bill doesn't, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill doesn't expressly address that scenario. And I should think that, for example, let's take the case of an insurance proceeds that are paid out. I think that probably the terms of an insurance contract would govern if the person who's the decedent reappears. I suspect that the terms of the contract between the policyholder and the insurance company would probably control as to what kind of remedies the insurer would have under those circumstances. I don't have a comprehensive answer for you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Let me just mention one other thing. Members of the committee, there are some Dash A4 amendments. I understand that these originate with the Department of Human Services. Basically what they do is provide the state medical examiner shall deposit the death certificate with the county registrar for a decedent presumed to be dead under this section. We don't have any objection to the A4 amendments. We don't understand that they have any fiscal impact, and they don't impact the policy of the bill in any way.
All right, Pete, the issue that I raised with respect to somebody suddenly reappearing, is there a need to address that in this bill, or do we just leave it kind of hanging?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me see if I can get an answer for you in the next day. Okay. And I'll provide that directly to you, and then the committee members can act upon that information as you and the committee members see fit.
All right, great. Thank you very much, then. That concludes. I think there's no one else signed up for the public hearing. Have the committee been notified of a potential meeting on Friday?
Yes. Where are we at?
Well, it's just holding it open just in the event that I find it necessary. Hopefully, if we do post some bills, members can be present. But it's just a kind of a read over time to pick up some. Okay? Any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.
No, that's
I
not
the
usual.
I was out of here, but I couldn't find it.
I know.
Get my note.